What's up, Dialed fam? Welcome to episode 181 of the Dialed Health Podcast. My name is Derek Teal. I'm the owner and head coach here at dialedhealth.com, which is strength training for cyclists. And joining me today on the podcast is a good friend and someone you're going to recognize from the Trainer Road podcast, and most likely their content across the board. It's Jonathan Lee. How's it going, man?
Going great, man. Thanks for having me on, Derek. Stoked to be here.
Yeah, I appreciate you making this happen. And true to brand, you scheduled this episode with me while you were on the rollers doing a Trainer Road workout.
Yeah, you gave me a call, and yeah, I knew that you would understand if I was breathy on the phone, so I didn't I didn't ignore the call. I answered it.
Well, I know you ride rollers, and it didn't really click until you were actually scheduling it on the calendar, and that's when I put it together. I'm like, wait, are you one-handed on the rollers right now scheduling? And I don't know what watts you were doing. We'll just say it was about 350. I think very talented.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's the Elite Neuro rollers are the ones I use, for those asking. So, because I bet that somebody will ask like what they use. They have erg mode and stuff. And they have like a kind of a fore and aft suspension system, and they're not metal, so they're quiet, which is really nice. So makes it a whole lot better.
Yeah. What are they? Are they plastic?
Yeah, plastic rollers. So a lot like the Tax rollers that you can use as well. Tax has plastic ones, and I'm sure perhaps other ones, but yeah, it works really well. Like, you don't need, you have a grippy tire, you don't need the crazy sharp knurled roller drum or even just like a steel drum. And it makes it really quiet. So,
yeah. Oh, that's good to know. Did you see the Lifetime Grand Prix athletes warming up on all the Tax rollers before the start?
Yeah. Kudos to Garmin for bringing them out and having them there.
Yes.
Because otherwise it's a pain for athletes to travel with them. So you'll see a lot of them traveling with the Feedback Sports Omnium. That's the little guy that has two small, really narrow drums in the rear for your rear wheel. And then the front, you actually take your front wheel off, and it's like a bipod basically for your front. But it's a pain to travel with. So kudos for them bringing them out. It's cool.
Yeah, they're incredible. They're so good at knowing athletes' real needs and addressing it. And funny enough, this is more of a confession, but I've never ridden rollers. I've never even tried them for fun, you know? So yeah, that's something I've been interested for a while.
Yeah, nobody really tries them for fun typically, you know what I mean? Like, but yeah, I actually started using them because way back when people didn't have power meters, like, I know that sounds weird, or didn't have smart trainers, way back in the day, there was this thing that we did called, and we still do it, called virtual power, where a person could have like a speed sensor on their bike and then just tell us what trainer they had. And then we'd build a basically like a curve that would show that like this trainer at this speed, you have to put out this many watts. So then that way they could train with power. And at one point I remember like we had enough people requesting for a specific set of rollers, and everyone in the office was like, not me. And then I was like, I guess I'll do it. So I figured it out, falling all over the place. And then after that, I really like it. It's just a bit more freedom, a bit more engagement for my brain and body to just like focus on. And it really punishes you for like sloppy pedaling. And
so I've heard that rollers will really help smoothen out your pedal stroke.
Yeah. And I've noticed that. I mean, I'm not some like rock steady, perfect pedaler or something. I don't want to get that across, but it certainly helped me. And I just find them enjoyable, a nice alternative. I have a smart trainer right next to it as well. And I typically use the TT bike on that. My TT position, I can ride the rollers, but I just don't feel very comfortable on it. I spend too much time focusing on like just staying stable. But yeah. And I honestly don't want to ride my TT bike very often. It's pretty miserable. So I like rollers. They're good.
Yeah. How hard would it be to go in and out of the TT position on that bike when you're on the rollers? Is that what it is? Or is it just getting complacent after maybe 10 minutes of sitting in those aero bars? Yeah.
I think the issue for me, at least at this point, is more like just the complacency, I guess. Like, you kind of like get into this position and you're just constantly, because your weight distribution is different, right? Like, so if more of your weight is over the front, and if that weight is sitting in front of the front axle, that's going to cause like more leverage, I guess, is maybe the right term. Engineers, sorry if I'm messing this up. And when that happens, then it places like much greater emphasis on any front wheel movement. And the weird thing about rollers is that everything works backwards. So like, if you turn your wheel to the left, then it actually makes you lean to the right in a weird way. So like, So a lot of the time, if you feel yourself drifting left, you'd like turn to the right to go away from going off the left side of the rollers. But when you do that, it actually kind of like makes you lean and fall even more in that direction. It's kind of weird. And you have to like recalibrate for it. And when you're doing that with all of your weight on aero bars way far forward, which on my triathlon position, it's not, or it's even further forward than it would be in like 40K TT. So it gets a little complicated, but I don't know. I could probably figure it out. I just don't like doing it that much.
That does make sense. And it actually made me think, this is one of those questions that I ask and I'm genuinely curious, but I know someone's going to be slapping their forehead because it sounds dumb, but can you get speed wobble on rollers?
No,
because,
I mean,
because when you talked about, okay, you turn the wheel left, your body leans right. What I envision is countering that. And this mini speed wobble high side situation.
Yeah.
Like, imagine high siding yourself off rollers in your garage. Like if that was a thing, your wife just hears you smack the wall.
Seriously. I've slammed the wall a few times, like to the side, but I think that it wouldn't be like speed wobbles because that's dealing with some sort of like weird tension and like, between the front wheel and the back wheel and some alignment issue. And it causes like those wobbles that get bigger, but you are absolutely right in saying that like people typically that ride the rollers, they're going left, right. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then their front wheel pops off the edge of the roller. Mm. And then that's like, and it kind of freaks them out. But the craziest thing that you have to decouple with your brain is you think like, dang, I'm pedaling hard and fast right now. And if I came off these rollers, I would like Looney Tunes my way through like that wall right in front of me, you know? And that's like what's going on in your mind. But when you, if you fall off your rollers, which I've done it tons of times where like, you know, your wheels pop off. And when you do that, your wheels can be spinning, you know, at 100 miles an hour, and it's nowhere near enough inertia to make you actually like move forward. You just, your wheels stop and you just, and it's very uneventful and you typically just like fall over. So
yeah, that would be weird.
But yeah, I like them. They're good fun, man.
Yeah. I'll have to try and do that. I think I'm going to start getting back on the trainer a little bit. It's funny because I predicted myself only riding the trainer when I got healthy enough to pedal because of the safety aspect. And this is crazy, but dude, I've lost almost 10 pounds of muscle off of my lower body. I actually just started weighing and measuring myself again. And I think visually it's noticeable. I notice it when I put my pants on. When you wear skinny jeans, there's no hiding. You know, you can feel what you're filling out and what you're not. And so my thought was, well, I really just want to get indoors, build up the muscle back, get confident. I don't want to ride outdoors until I feel like I could lay it over and be okay. But it's crazy because I've only been getting outdoors initially. And I think that was because I put a shorter crank setup on my mountain bike and I put the 135s on and I was like, well, I'm just going to go pedal on the bike trail. And it also helps that the weather's been perfect, perfect spring weather. And so then I got back on my gravel bike, which has my normal 172.5s and kind of my normal setup. It's been a real stretch, but I put in 100 miles last week on it, which
wow, it's a big week.
Right. Like it's funny because it didn't feel like I overdid it. And the last ride, the last couple of miles, I said, okay, I have a planned rest day tomorrow. This is perfect. I feel the fatigue and I was able to rest and get some good recovery. But I bring all that up because I am excited to get back on the turbo again and just work on my pedal stroke, get some smoother power and be able to focus on my pedaling without the other things going on around me because I want to ride a little differently moving forward. I want to ride a lot more patient and I'm trying to pedal with a leg that doesn't want to do it. And I'm also trying to not crash and change my riding style and focus on my surroundings. So there's been a lot of incoming things, plus just the random trauma that will come up throughout the ride. And so I bring all that up because I'm very excited to get back on the turbo. And actually, one of the reasons I want to have this conversation with you was because I'm curious as to what your thoughts are about me getting back on the bike at this point, being as detrained as I am and having these injuries. Because like I said, I rode 100 miles last week because it just felt so good to be out. And yeah. I basically rode every day. But what are your thoughts on getting back into training? Because I want someone to talk a little sense into me before I get too carried away with whatever idea I get.
Yeah, I think, and can we just take a little bit of a moment here to like separate your situation from somebody that has had another injury? Like, it doesn't matter what the injury is, like everything is unique. And if you're listening to this and you've been like sick for, you know, a number of days or weeks, this, you're also not Derek. So like, principles, we'll try to isolate principles, but by all means, like, what Derek is doing is probably not the best path for anybody else. And your path of you listening to this is likely not better for anybody else. Like, so I think it's key. There are some principles though, for sure, I think that are important. Like, I was honestly pretty surprised to see you back on the bike and riding outside, but also at the same time, I bet psychologically you were probably, like, I don't know. Let me know. I kind of feel like you want to go back and confront and kind of like, I mean, cause you've got to have Derek like with this, and you've been public about sharing this on your social channels and everything else, but there's a lot of trauma involved that is not just physical with this experience that you've had. And I'm sure that with your personality and the person that you are, you probably want to go back and face the fears that you have and kind of like get them, like just spend that time to be able to reckon with them. And I would assume that riding out on the road, you've had a little bit of a time to do that already.
Yeah. That's been a major thing. And I'm happy that I guess just leaned into those fears as fast as I have. It is definitely my personality. I don't know if it'd be a good call for everybody, but I feel like I haven't let any trauma dwell for any longer than it needs to. And I've been really lucky because of my support system. You know, I have a rock solid wife at home who's the most content person I've ever met and insanely encouraging. I have a close family around me that I know would do anything for me. I have a close relationship with the community at my church who I can get prayer for weekly. And I have people praying for me around the world nonstop. And so there's all these layers that have helped me mentally get back to the point where I'm comfortable to ride again. But I think the biggest individual piece besides the prayer has been the trauma therapy I went to. And I did it right before Sea Otter, which was perfect timing. I actually discussed it on the last episode, but you know, a lot of people want to know what happened and a lot of cyclists want to know about some gore and some details. And there was plenty of that. So having to discuss it so many times over and over again, I think it's almost good if you've been through the steps in the right way. So yeah, you're totally right. I mean, I've already been out to the corner that I got hit on, and I went out there just on crutches, and I am looking forward to being able to ride back out there. I just can't ride that far yet. It's a little bit out of my radius at the moment, but I'm getting close. And I think when I can, I will. I'll probably make sure I go out there with somebody when I go, because I think that's the thing about trauma is that you don't know when something is going to set you off. And that's been one of the weirdest things that I've experienced through it, because I've never had a trigger like that in my life. And it's gotten a lot better, but yeah, I think getting back out and facing that has been important, but I also know there's so many other benefits to me pedaling again besides healing my leg itself. It's being outside in the sun. It's the ritual of riding. That's one thing I didn't realize I missed so much. Filling up my bottles, putting on my kit, throwing some sunscreen on my face, going out and riding, the shower afterwards, the way you feel. There's all of these layers to it. At the moments where you're on a descent and you feel like you're flying. I've already had that again, and it's so awesome. When it's taken away from you, you forget that, oh, I don't want to just go out and do an effort and set some power PR. I want the whole experience. And
yeah,
that's, I think, why I've been wanting to go out. And again, the weather's been perfect. So it's been a really nice time to go out, even though my allergies have been crazy. But but yeah, those are all the reasons why I've ended up, I think, going out and wanting to, you know, face the fears is part of it, but not the whole story.
Yeah. And I think that's really the first thing that I wanted to talk about is like, depending on why you have taken time off from the bike, I feel like you have to, if you don't have desire to do something, you don't have motivation. And sometimes you can have desire and motivation, but there are blocks that are standing in the way of something like that. If you don't have that, you have to find a way to rekindle it. There are a lot of times I feel like where athletes will force themselves back into something before they're actually ready to go back into it, not just physically, but like, you know, emotionally and psychologically going into it. And so I think that's like a key part is, breaks can really, just like you said, it can really illuminate our perspective on why we do something and the benefit we get from it. And it's really good to align, ourselves to that, to make sure that we aren't, you know, maybe our identity is wrapped up into it. And instead we feel like we need to fulfill our identity to other people rather than just riding the bike because we love it. And with a break like yours, that isn't just like an illness break, but it's really something serious. I think that that's an like key thing to discuss, but physically speaking, your injury has like so much trauma associated with like everything that, that happened to your body within it, that there's zero manual on like how to come back from this thing. You know, like the old, like Belgic as they hear, or like the, you know, the Belgian logic where it's like, if it's below the chest or if it's above the chest, then you can train. If it's below the chest, don't train. I don't believe that first of all, but just to this point, like there is no old wives' tale. There is no straightforward way on how to come back from it. So, but I think that the big thing is a lot of athletes will jump back in and hope that they can become who they once were, and they're holding to that. And instead, you just have to accept where you're at, and where you're at isn't right or wrong. There's no moral value to it either. It's just where you are. Like, it's, so you start where you are, and the, if you ride, you love the process, and then you just let it work from there. But I think like practically speaking, getting into that, it's like setting your FTP lower than you think that you need it to be. It's instead of doing 2 hour rides, cause that's what you always did during the week, and then a 4 hour ride on the weekend, it's doing a 30 minute ride and seeing how you feel after the 30 minute ride. And then only stepping up maybe to an like hour long rides and capping yourself at that for a week, maybe 2 weeks, and then you allow yourself to come back slowly but surely. But I think that those, like the key principles here are, you don't hold yourself to what you once were, and instead you meet yourself where you're at and you take it just like a step at a time. So, I mean, looking at you, yeah, I mean, you have a level of body awareness that probably most of us don't have. And I don't think that you'd be making like hasty decisions or anything else like that with getting onto it and getting back in. But the issue that we see all the time is just athletes come back too quick. I'm not sure how it will work in your situation because I haven't personally looked at this. It does use AI, so I assume that it's quite comprehensive, but we have this feature called red light, green light that does help people when they come back from training. And like, it's super impressive at how it's able to ramp you back up at a sustainable rate. And it's learned this from analyzing over like 250 million activities from athletes around the world. And it basically knows that like who you are as a biodemographical individual, then also who you are as the true individual that Derek is. And so it knows how you adapt to training at like a really deep level. And then it just makes sure that you're taking it in stride. And I think that that's a big thing that I'm really eager to see what that effect is in like 6 months to a year on so many athletes. If they listen to it, of course, you know, they could, they could still ignore it and just keep blowing through it. But if they listen to it, I think it's going to help a bunch of people. You know, oddly enough, you get back to full strength faster when you take your time through it at the appropriate pace than if you just try to force yourself back into it.
You know, that's a crazy insight that you've noticed, because you have so much data on athletes. To say that the majority of athletes come back too quickly, I think does say a lot. And it's definitely the type A mentality that a lot of, I think, endurance focused cyclists have. And who knows what the motive is? Is it fear that you're losing your fitness, or is it trying to fulfill your identity, or is it just this genuine desire to go ride? You know, that's up to the individual, but it will be interesting to see how I do with that going forward, because I already know riding style when I'm outdoors riding, specifically on the road, I just want to be more patient, even on the mountain bike. And it's those little things. Are there people clogging up the bike path? Are there cars at an intersection that have stop signs? You can't assume that they're going to do what they're supposed to do. I've learned that the hard way. And so a little bit of patience, I think, could be honestly the answer for most cyclists to stay out of a lot of trouble, or to avoid to get I was going to say to avoid avoidable trouble. I don't know a better way to say that. There are all of these scenarios that could be avoided with a little bit more patience. I guess that's the best way to say it. And I know that going out, that's something that I've been really focused on changing. But when it comes to even efforts, it's crazy to have so much time on the roads in your area and to know the data of what you can do. Or for example, I just went up Park Drive, which is a hill I've Everested on. This was the last ride I did 2 days ago. And it's 250 feet vert. Why I chose it was, I don't know, a bad idea. I just did it on a random New Year's Day. But I had to do 117 laps to Everest on this thing. And it took like 12 hours. It was ridiculous. But I did it. And the weather was freezing. It was crazy. But I went out on my ride and I literally was just hoping to get up at once. And I honestly didn't know if I had the strength to do so. Thankfully, I had my gravel bike and gravel bike gearing, which was that mullet setup, nice little 52 on the back. But even then, it wasn't that easy to get up. I think at one point there's like a 9.5 or 11% pitch for a short duration. But I rode up it and I was like, gosh, that was kind of hard. And I wasn't sure if I could even really do it. And you know, I've done 117 laps up this thing with smaller gears, like no problem. So it's just this perspective where on one hand, you're thinking this is demoralizing, but on another, you're like, gosh, I'm so happy that I'm not in a wheelchair. I'm so happy that my leg is getting better. You know, I have the opportunity to recover. And so it's, there's all these things happening at once. And it's just very tough mentally. But I think physically the thing that's been the best about this injury for me is that it has shown me that I don't need to force things. One of my mottos, and I got this from Wim Hof, the Iceman, who does all the cold exposure stuff you guys have probably seen. He was doing this Q&A video and someone was asking like, how long should I be in hot water? How long should I do heat? How many rounds should I do? And he just basically stopped. He's like, stop stressing about the details. Listen to your body. And he's like, do not force it. If you feel like you need to get out early, just get out. If you feel like you can stay in longer, just stay longer. And he said, forcing equals destruction. And I thought for myself, I was like, wow, that should really be the motto of this recovery for me. Because for better or for worse in the past, whether it's my fitness or business or anything, I have forced a lot of things. And I don't regret a lot of it. It's gotten me to where I'm at in a lot of areas, but I've also realized that a lot of things shouldn't have been forced, where they kind of led to more destruction than actual benefit. And my body's so fragile at the moment that I could for sure hurt myself in a real way by pushing through, by saying, no, you have to get up this climb. No, you have to add a mile every ride that you do. Oh, you have to add this amount of volume every single week. And because that is my normal personality. So I'm really proud of how that side of it's gone. But I also feel like I do need the continual perspective from other people who I trust in regards to training like yourself, just to bring myself back to reality. Like, I don't want to get carried away back into that way of thinking.
Yeah. And this is the ramp rate thing is really interesting, because you'll see some people like codify this whole process and they'll be like, you need to ramp up your CTL by 1 to 2 points each week. And if you do that, then that's going to be sustainable. And that's like, per month. And honestly, that's, I just disagree with any sort of like direct approach of ramping back up. And you'll see people say that like, you can only ramp TSS by, you know, in a sustainable ramp, you can see a 10% increase in TSS, but anything more than that, and it's going to blow up. And I also don't agree with that. But I think that you have to look ahead and like, you have to say, okay, I am going to ramp things up. Where is my ambition? Because most of you listening to this are probably type A athletes like Derek. You have to look at like, where is my ambition? Okay. Can I split the difference from where I'm at to where my ambition is? And can I just see how that goes? Like, and if you start there and then see how that goes, chances are, because you are so ambitious, you could have put yourself in a spot where it may not have been the end of the world, but you would have just been balancing on the edge. Whereas now what you're doing is you have enough wiggle room to be able to allow life to intervene and to, you know, like you said, Derek, like soon you're going to have like a weird issue where like scar tissue is going to cause a problem and then it's going to like break free and you're going to feel like a new human and then you're going to have something else coming. But you're going to have a, to quote Lance and from the We Do crew, you know, you're going to have a forward, like forward, never straight. Like that is your limit.
Yes.
And like, yes. So because of that, if you are always pushing things to the stops, and we do that by following our ambitions, by the way, or by following what other people say we should do. And if you're doing that, you're going to be pushed against the stops, and any deviation means you fall off the edge. Like, isn't it better in life to like not live that leveraged? Like you want to have, you don't want to have zero in your bank account. You know what I mean? Like, I know that you can pay all your bills and you can probably do all that stuff and you can calculate it out and get right there, but life intervenes, you know? So I just advise people to kind of split the difference. And instead of looking at something that's a very objective, this is the way to quantify it and to move forward. Look at where your ambition is and cut that in half and then see how that feels and then step forward from there. I think it's just super, super crucial. And I got to say, the one thing that I really think is beneficial about, and to be clear, Trainer Roads, indoors, outdoors, you can do all your work outside, everything else. So this is not a company man thing here. I just think that the benefit of the indoor trainer for you and your recovery is it allows you to step off, and it doesn't put you in a position where it's like, I need to get up this climb.
Right.
I need to do something like that, or I need to go a little bit further. Instead, it allows you the space to be like, oh no, that pain was a bit different than the normal pain I've been experiencing. I need to check that out right now. And I need to go and do a session of like mobility work instead. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you're, you know, 10 miles away from home, you're not going to do that.
Yeah.
You might be able to stop and stretch or something else, but you're going to be incentivized to not do that. Like you want to carry on your speed. You're going to be thinking about your average speed compared to where you want it to be. You're going to be doing all these things.
I have let that go. I have thankfully let that go right now.
Good. I think that's a key thing about indoor training is it allows that. That's why I ran on the treadmill like almost exclusively for like a year before I got to the point where I was running outside, because I was way too ambitious and I was getting hurt when I was learning to run, and I forced myself to just do the treadmill embarrassingly slow and short, and that allowed me to step off.
With a running warm up, to do a proper running warm up, your average speed is done right away. You know what I mean? If you're going to actually do a quality running warm up before you get into your efforts, it's going to look horrible.
Yeah.
You're going to look so slow. And so that is a total temptation when it comes to that. And it is definitely with riding. I mean, I've noticed that even at intersections, when I have to get going again, I mean, I look like it's my first day on the bike, and I'm unclipping 20 feet away as I roll into the intersection. Yeah, I'm doing all the beginner things just because I'm trying to be so careful.
Yeah.
And this is kind of a side note, but one of the weirdest things about riding outdoors right now, it's not that I feel scared with cars, but I feel, and part of that has to do with actually using radar now, the Garmin Varia whole setup and having all the alerts set up. That has been amazing. Very, very
can't
free.
Ride without it.
Oh, can't ride man. Without I, it. I always use the light, but I never used to use the radar. And so really stoked about that. That's helped a lot, but I feel very vulnerable because I can't ride defensively from a technical standpoint. I can honestly say I've avoided a lot of accidents in the past because of my technical ability coming from gravity mountain biking. I can bunny hop curbs. I can sprint over here. I can slam on my brakes and not go over the bars. Like there's all these little things I know how to do. I can, you know, pivot and track stand and weave between cars, like all things that I've done. But I can't do any of that right now. I can barely stand and pedal. And so I feel like a sitting duck going through an intersection, and some are longer than others. You know, you have to get going again and it's so slow. And those are the times where I feel so vulnerable and I'm like, gosh, I don't like this side of it. And it's not enough to stop me from riding, especially because my awareness is so much higher. And thankfully I am on a bike. I mean, I'll tell you multiple times walking through intersections in the past few months where I'm on crutches or on a cane, dude, I have hit that buzzer and literally had to flag cars down to stop because I can't make it across the crosswalk fast enough. Oh my gosh. It's just insane to think about. But, Yeah, I'm sorry. I got totally sidetracked on the vulnerability part. I think I thought of it because when you said getting off the trainer, like you can always stop. That's one thing I thought of was like, wow, when I'm in an intersection, no matter how uncomfortable or awkward it feels, I can't take my time. And that has been probably the weirdest moment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I think that like coming back to training, there's no clear path. You have to be realistic and totally accept where you're at. Like chances are none of us here are paid for our performances, or very few of us. There's actually probably quite a few listen to this that are paid for their performances on a bike too. But the majority of us listen to this, we aren't paid for our performances on our bike. Like really what you do is you train, and like the riding part's the reward. And for all of us, we need to step back and recognize the fact that when I train at 100 watts or when I train at 200 watts, it doesn't matter. It's just me training and I'm just trying to get better. And like the sooner you can do that. And I feel like just with being a dad and getting sick constantly with kids and just having a full plate, you know, like that's really forced me to kind of let go of that and recognize it. And I feel like it's made me a better athlete. So if you're listening to this and you're coming back like Derek, give yourself time. Just accept where you're at. You know,
I actually remember where I was going before I sidetracked, and it was your comment about walking that fine line of destruction or feeling like, okay, I'm doing this amount of training. It's the max I can handle. But if one little thing happens to knock me off, I'm shut down, or I'm constantly teetering being sick because I'm a little overtrained or whatever it is. It reminded me of an interview with Mateo Jorgensen after he won Paris-Nice, and they were talking about what he's been doing differently with his training this year. Mm-hmm. And I think it was actually on WeDo. He said he has training with a similar, you could probably say this as well as I could or better, but it sounded like he's just not as tired as he used to be. He's doing a little less intensity. He's letting his body recover. And you know, you can't mistake that for him not training insanely hard. I mean, I'm sure the volume is through the roof, and I'm sure when he does efforts there, they'd be impossible for us to follow. Yeah. But at whatever level he's at, he backed off enough to make sure he can recover more and he's riding faster. Yeah. And so I thought that was really interesting, and it was inspiring for me to not walk that fine line either, because I actually think I've was kind of plateauing because of that.
Yeah. Well, I think that one clear distinction, I don't think, and I could be wrong, but I don't think that Mateo said that he was doing less intensity. It sounded like his hard workouts were extremely hard, but it sounds like he was just doing less and balancing it with recovery. I think that's probably the best way to say it. And the reason I bring that up is that a lot of look, intensity has been enduring this 5-year negative PR campaign. Like, and it's been really, really profound.
Zone 2, baby. I can only train zone 2.
Yeah. And I think that as a result, I think a lot of people think that anything that isn't intense is benign, meaning that like, it's not going to harm and I can just do as much as I want. And I see more athletes, I still see more athletes doing too much, but it usually comes from like unstructured group rides where they're just like, well, I had a blast. And they don't realize like, hey, you spent like on that 4-hour ride, you spent like, you know, 57 minutes above your threshold, you know, like, and they're like, really? Like, I thought it was just like a fun Z2 ride, you know? And so I do see a lot of that, but I think the bigger, like a very big problem that I see is just a lot of athletes doing too much of the low intensity stuff and not realizing that that actually, even though it doesn't feel hard in the moment, it causes a lot of systemic fatigue. Like it's aerobic training. Like it's not like as if it's just like, you know, not having an effect on you. It's intentional. Like if you do a lot of that, it brings about aerobic fitness. So I think that with no matter what side of the scale you're tipping, intensity or volume, right? If you're just pushing yourself to the limits, then it's going to get manifest in like, you're going to be a grumpy person. You're going to be more upset. You're going to be more angry. I don't know. You're also going to get sick more often. You're going to plateau. You're going to feel like you can't improve, not be able to manifest the power that you think you can do. And so, yeah, but it just, you just gotta, whether it's intensity or volume, just don't push yourself to the stops, you know? So.
Yeah. It's so funny too, because I have this instinct in me as we're talking about this, where I worry that we're being too easy on people or too light on people, and they'll run with it. And I think it's because of being with the trainer, working with people one-on-one for so long, you see these habits where someone will latch on to that thing they want to hear. And they're like, oh, you say train easier. Well, then they go way too far with it, you know, and that terrifies me. And I actually, one thing I'm really stoked about with this recovery is that I don't feel like I need a disclaimer pushing people like I used to, because there was always this sense where they're like, well, you're, you know, early 30s, fit, healthy, you don't have anything standing in your way kind of thing. And now it's nice to say with some confidence that, no, I will do whatever I can in whatever given situation. And I think that's a lot of athletes in general. It's, you're going to do what you can given whatever circumstance, even if that's putting little baby cranks on your mountain bike and riding the bike trail and getting passed by 7-year-old grandmas. I mean, that literally happened to me. I was like, dude, I was like, that lady is my grandma's age and she just came past me and she's not on an e-bike. And so anyways, I mean, my pedals have had reflectors on them for the last 3 weeks.
That's good. So, good for you. I know, right? Heck yeah.
So I think that's the thing. It's like, okay, I just always have to nudge it in there that, you know, try it and not run with something too far like that. But I think that the message of, wow, you don't have to be exhausted all the time to know that you're making progress is probably a really good thing. And I think a lot of people could benefit from, including myself.
100%. Me too. Yeah. I'm saying it, but I need to hear myself, you know, so.
But when I can get back to some intensity, what I'm really looking forward to is getting back on the mountain bike. And what I'm looking forward to even more is this new Epic 8 that just came out. I'm personally very curious what your thoughts have been riding the new Epic 8, because you got one. It's beautiful. By the way, is 76, is that your moto number? I see it on your top tube.
No, it's my son's birthday, July 6th. And
nice.
I have it on all my bikes there. And it just reminds me that I love him. He makes me excited about life. And
love it.
Like, whenever I see that, it makes me grateful. Makes me also want to like push hard and strive, because I think that that's like the example that I want to set for him too. And so, yeah, that's what I have on my bikes all the time.
I love that. Dang, that's so cool. I figured it was a moto thing. But no, that's way more powerful.
Yeah.
So, you had that on top too. The build's beautiful. Your previous bike was an Epic Evo, your previous mountain bike.
Correct.
And what's interesting about the new Epic and the new Epic Evo is that the Epic now almost seems to be more comparable to the Epic Evo.
Correct.
And the new Epic Evo is kind of,
it's like a stump jumper almost.
Pure downcountry bike. Yeah, it's like a stump jumper build, but with more XC Geo.
Yeah.
At least like bottom bracket height, those types of things, which I've noticed coming from all the trail bikes over the years. Like, I've ridden every type of trail bike. And getting on XC geometry was so strange, to not have a low bottom bracket, to have a lower front end, those things. But then again, they're so much better for pedaling and just riding all day. So it is a give and take. But I'm kind of curious, how has it been transitioning from the old generation Epic Evo to the new Epic 8?
Yeah, I think like, and to be clear, I'm not sponsored or anything else like that. I did buy this bike at a discount from a local shop, Sierra Bike Supply. It was very kind of them to give me a discount. It wasn't some huge discount or something. This bike was really expensive. And I didn't have the budget to afford the complete build with flight attendant. It was just too much. So with that out of the way, it was not... I think it's really good to set expectations. This is not a revolution as much as it is an evolution, in the sense that you're going to get on the bike, and if you've ridden an Epic Evo before, it's going to feel familiar, quite familiar. It'll just do a handful of things better. And depending on the athlete, I feel like those handful of things that it does better actually could have a pretty significant change. So it's funny because the Geo looks actually, you know, it looks slacker. The seat tube looks steeper and the front center looks longer, or the reach looks longer. Right. And as a result, like, a lot of people are thinking like, oh, I got to go for like a shorter stem and I've got to do all that stuff. And I'm not really sure that you'll need to. When you get on the bike, it just feels like home. If you're used to an Epic Evo from before, it just feels the same. For example, I thought that I had a 100 millimeter -17 stem on my a previous Epic Evo, and I'm 5'10", basically 5'11", and I was running a medium frame. So that was on my previous Epic Evo. And on this one, I was like, I'm going to need to drop down to a 90, just looking at the numbers. And I was probably trusting my terrible, like, high school level trigonometry, which is, I was never good at it anyway. And looking at that, I was like, all right, cool. I'll go a 90. And when I got the 90, I felt a little cramped. Like, I felt a little shorter. Now, maybe I just need to get used to it. I don't know. But I went back to 100 mil on this one. And there's a couple interesting things. So, like, I'll step back from the stem discussion and get back to that in just a bit here. The one thing there, or there's three things that this bike does really well compared to the previous Epic Evo. The previous Epic Evo I had at a two position lockout setup. So you were open or you were locked. And when I got the bike, I went to lock it out and I set up like a twist lock on there. So it was nice and easy to do, really clean setup. I went to lock it out and the suspension was still moving around. And I was like, man, I don't want that. Like, I want my bike in the open mode to pedal efficiently. And then locked, I really do want it fully locked because there are rare situations where I will want that. Mm-hmm. For me, it's not that rare because I train on the road on my mountain bike all the time for safety. And then also because it's the bike that I want to ride. You know, if a car is coming up behind me or something and it's sketchy, I can go onto the dirt and I don't have to worry about losing control on a road bike. Right.
Right. I'm sorry. I got to say, riding a mountain bike on the road is the worst experience. Anytime I see a guy riding a mountain bike on a road, I'm like, that's a real mountain biker right there. And my whole history is in mountain biking.
Yeah.
But I can't say I'm like a real XC rider.
Yeah.
I can do short stints on the road, but beyond that, I just want to pull my hair out.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's about specificity and safety. And I think that, like,
it makes sense, though. Like, you're like training. Yeah. It's specificity.
Yeah.
For sure. Exactly. And the safety aspect is interesting because I've ridden some of the roads in your areas. And that is a situation. If you're on a fast highway, there's almost always a dirt pullout you could jump into if you needed to.
Right. Yeah. So with that, I wanted to have a bike that would be full lockout. So I actually changed the shock tune and everything else. And the fork would lock out, but the shock wouldn't. It was a really weird situation. So I changed the shock tune, like manually went through and tweaked and adjusted it with the guys at Sierra Bike Supply. And we changed like shock weight oil and all that, or shock oil weight and all this stuff. And shim stacks. And we got it to the point where the bike sure didn't descend like it was just a wide open plush DH bike. It was a bit firmer, but at the same time, it was very much within spec for me. Like, it descended great. And then it pedaled incredibly well. And then if I locked it, it was locked. So that's my point of reference that I'm coming at. Now, what they did on this bike is they have wide open on the new Epic 8. They have wide open, normal damping. Then they have a setting that they call magic middle, which is the middle section. And then they have full lock. And that full lock is properly fully locked. That magic middle section is firmer than my open section that I had for sure. But it pedals so incredibly well. And it covers ground like on the trail. It still absorbs chatter. It still absorbs hard bumps. You still have enough plushness to kind of like maintain traction. But I will be spending on most trails like 95% of my time, my bike will be in that magic middle setting. Wow. And they did a really good job on tuning the suspension, I think. Like, so as a result, compared to the normal Epic Evo without the tune that I had on my old one, that bike, it bobbed a bit more. It wasn't quite as efficient when it was wide open. This bike, when it's wide open, feels more efficient pedaling than that bike. And when it's wide open on descending, it feels very, very good. Way more plush, carries momentum better. I notice a pretty significant difference. Like, I think that if I was to time myself, especially on anything chunky, I think that I would carry substantially more speed on the Epic 8 than I would on the Epic Evo. And it's because of the fact that it just is allowed to move through its travel with way less resistance. Like, it just, it's plush, it eats, and it's way better in that regard. So like it's the geometry, I think, also helps it descend a bit better too. Feels a bit more trail bikey. But man, the biggest difference that I've noticed is just like, I feel like I don't have to compromise at all anymore with that three position setup, and it is efficient. It's also crazy light. The SWAT door that they have to store stuff inside the frame is the best iteration of a in-frame storage that I've seen. Like, it's very clean, will not rattle, gives you all like a large enough access for it.
Dude, and that is so nice to have. I miss that from my trail bikes because my generation Epic Evo doesn't have the SWAT storage. And there's all sorts of stuff you can do. I have a trail wallet that I put all my spares in and keep it in a jersey pocket, but then you're down a full jersey pocket.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Real estate.
It is precious real estate. I mean, thankfully we have good cargo bibs now, which have been helpful, but yeah, having the frame storage, it's one of those things that you don't think you really need it. And then you have it and you're like, oh wow, that's nice. I mean, even just to have your flat repairs in it alone is awesome.
Yeah. And I think the biggest thing, and I don't know if I'm picking up on this or not, and I know the guy that's the product manager on this, which by the way, I think a lot of people like to paint Specialized. And again, I'm not sponsored here, but a lot of people like to paint Specialized as just like a big numb corporate marketing machine. And I can't speak for every aspect of the company, but it could not be further from the truth for like the, at least on the cross country mountain bike side. And what Brian and his team do, they are obsessed with improvement. And they are riders themselves and they're testing constantly. And I think I was talking to Brian and he said like a couple bolts are the only things that are the same on this bike. Wow. I know it looks really similar, but nothing else is the same. And just last night when I was washing, I was noticing like the differences in the rear triangle. I'm like, oh, it bows out more there. And I feel like the frame is stiffer when I'm descending, and that is better. That's one thing that like they actually, Brian asked me for like feedback on the previous Evo, you know, years back and on the previous Epic. And I was like, I want more chassis stiffness. Cause in moments of like hard hits or something else, I get some vagueness and I get a bit of unpredictability out of the frame. And this one so far, and I, you know, I haven't had a full season on it or something, but feels so much more like composed and calm. And the suspension is just letting everything pass through the suspension. Super impressive. I'm only running one volume spacer in the fork right now. I might even go to zero. Like,
really?
And that's because the tune of everything is set up so that just front to rear matches perfectly. I love it, man. It's an incredible bike. And I'm stoked. Downeville is the main goal. And I feel like this bike is an upgrade from what I had from the Epic Evo, particularly for Downeville. It's going to be great for it. So,
dude, that's awesome. I'm so stoked for you to get out to Downeville. I hope the event is insane this year. It seems like the push toward endurance, even in mountain biking, is as big as it's been in a long time, and the energy behind it. I mean, being at the Lifetime Grand Prix race at Sea Otter and seeing the amount of racers and energy behind that event was crazy. It seems like a crazy shift in the industry right now, which has been really fun to watch. And I'm grateful for it because, you know, that's the stuff that I'm into right now as well. And these are the athletes that we get to help. So I'll speak for the whole Dialed fam. We're really stoked to watch you through Downeyville. And thanks for the info on that bike, because now I really want to go ride it.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. Sure. And dude, thanks for the time for coming on here. It's funny for people listening. I called Jonathan and we started talking. I was like, you know, I want to ask you about the bike. I want to ask you about just getting back into riding, you know, give some updates. But are you game to just record it for the podcast? And that's pretty much what we just ended up doing. So yeah, thanks again for coming on, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, grateful for it. And grateful, by the way, for Dialed Health. Just want to plug Dialed Health for anybody that listened to this that has not signed up. It's huge for me. Like for my strength training and everything else, I don't have a bunch of equipment. I have a kettlebell, and I do, whether it's your kettlebell flow stuff or your no equipment core, no equipment hit. Like there's a bunch of stuff that I do that because of Dialed Health, it makes it so that I can carry on my strength training, and our kids do it with me. It's hilarious and fun, and it's just awesome. So dude, you're just doing amazing stuff, man, and you're helping a lot of people. And if anybody's listening to this and hasn't signed up, they definitely need to. So
thanks. Well, I appreciate that. And I'm going to follow it up with go and get yourself a subscription to Trainer Road. It's been huge. The community is insane. The product, even as we were kind of mentioning before, can be used indoors or outdoors. And what they're doing with all of their AI work is just awesome. So yeah, dude, thanks a lot. I'll make sure to plug your socials in the description below.
Cool.
And that's it for everyone listening. Until next time, start moving forward.